Hello, listeners. Michael Vucci here. The following is not supposed to be a podcast, but my med school friend Marie was putting together a video for her show Yatropexy, which is why it's an interview with me. However, the video is cut down to about 5 minutes in length, and our actual conversation lasted around half an hour. Therefore, I'm presenting an extended edition exclusively for you guys over here. So without further ado, please enjoy Yatropexy, Episode 2. Introduction to Medieval Medicine.
I have with me today a friend of mine, Michael Wujcik of One Last Sketch, who is also beginning a master's in history at McGill University, and he's going to help me figure out where healthcare was in the medieval period. So hello, Mike, how are you today?
Good.
All right, excellent. Nice confident answer there. And just to clarify, we're looking at Europe in the medieval period. Yes. There's lots of interesting things happening in lots of other places, but a lot of people think of Europe when they think of the medieval period because the sort of Anglo-centric view, I don't know. I'm sure we could do
Eurocentric specifically.
Yeah, that would make sense. This is why I have you on. okay, so when exactly are we looking at for medieval period?
We'll generally go with the accepted time, which is from the fall of the Roman Empire, so about 500 AD to 1453, the fall of Constantinople.
Okay, and
the end of the Hundred Years' War.
Okay, so what is it that makes it that sort of special? I get the fall of the Roman Empire because it's the end of the classical period, but what is it that starts happening after the Hundred Years' War that makes a break there?
There's a lot of factors that would go into that. Specifically, we would be looking at the various crusades and the bringing in of outside sources of information, cultural exchange, that really came to a head in the 15th century,
okay.
Specifically early 15th century. Late 14th century is when you start getting better ships and a better spread of merchants moving around the world from Italy. That's why the Italian Renaissance comes first, because they developed travel technologies first.
Okay. So then,
and
after,
also because they had contact in the Mediterranean world and Islamic world specifically.
So then, after the Hundred Years' War, that's the early modern period, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Renaissance, early modern period.
Yeah, and that's the really crazy time. Okay, so then, speaking of the craziness that is actually the early modern period, what misconceptions do people usually have about the medieval period?
Well, a lot of those misconceptions specifically are actually things that happened in the early modern period as opposed to the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the things that we associate with the Middle Ages now generally belong to the Renaissance, like plate armor, two-handed swords weren't really common in the Middle Ages.
The witch
or
trials.
Or things like witch burnings, yep.
Yeah.
The Spanish Inquisition, which would be late medieval period. And some things we ascribe to the Middle Ages that didn't exist at all, like chastity belts.
Yeah, that'll be a different podcast. Video log thing.
I could say a lot about chastity.
I know you can, we're not going there. Okay, so of medicine at the time, because this is kind of a healthcare video log, do people tend to think about medicine?
Oh, that's extremely unsophisticated and had absolutely nothing to do with classical medicine. There was generally a break after the fall of the Roman Empire between how things were practiced in late antiquity and the way that physicians would have practiced medicine in Middle Ages, or if there were worse physicians at all.
Yeah, there's that kind of the idea of, like, the Library at Alexandria gets burnt down and all knowledge is lost. It's sort of the idea. So is that untrue, then?
That is not true.
Okay. How
medicine
is it?
Generally continued on from Greco-Roman,
okay.
Was incorporated into Christian thought.
Hmm. Okay. And, okay, so then at the time, what was the sort of level did it drop down at all after the classical period, or was it more or less the same?
Well, if we're going to put it on a sliding scale, you would say that it did drop down, because particularly in regards to sanitation, which is a big one, but that's mostly because the general infrastructure to put in place those sort of things didn't really exist.
Although, as far as I know, Pompeii had sewage running in the streets after a while.
Yes, well, we also tend to ascribe too much advancement to people in the classical period. I mean, they did have indoor plumbing in the Minoan civilization, but not so much everywhere else.
True. That's another video log of itself, too.
Yes, sanitation.
So we'll leave that one.
If we're going to look at medicine, there's two kinds, academic medicine and folkloric medicine. The problem with studying folklore is that most of this would have been passed down through oral traditions, which haven't survived. So if we're going to focus on any kind of medicine back then, it would be best to focus on academic.
So then, what was academic medicine actually like at the time?
It's a continuation of Hippocratic medicine, which is based around the thoughts that not that obviously they didn't have germ theory, but that the balance of elements in your body was what would determine your health.
Okay,
so balance of the four humors, blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm.
So I gave you this picture from the McKinney Collection of Medieval Medical Illustrations. Yes. And I believe you, when we were talking before, you were saying that that was pretty much what this is.
Yes, we have each of the four humors, which were tied to the four elements. And each one had a different state or quality, which was hot, cold, wet, dry. But the key to having a healthy body was to keep your body in a state of harmony and balance. An unhealthy body was imbalanced. And the main difference between medieval medicine and classical medicine was that idea that what would lead to imbalance in the body was various sins, certain behaviors that came from sin, and the way to avoid illness was to cure your moral failings.
Great.
I said that medieval medicine did key things towards sin, but it's also important to remember that that wasn't everything. That's one major mistake that we can make when thinking about medieval medicine. Like, if you grew old, then sickness was seen as a natural thing. And illness was rarely seen as being caused by individual sin, but by collective sin, and also our natural sinful state, the fall from grace. Except for leprosy, because if you got leprosy, that was your own fault.
Great. I shouldn't laugh at that. That's awful. But so then, if somebody, this is a difficult question to really be able to answer, but if you had a person who was born with a deformity, was that just a manifestation of their inner sinful state?
Yeah, that would generally be seen as just part of the human condition.
Okay.
As opposed to you being naturally, you having committed a specific sin in the womb.
Yeah. The mother might
disagree. Which, while amusing to think about, wasn't really considered possible.
Yeah. Are these different organs connected to stars in the sun? That's what this looks like in this picture.
Yes, well, it's tying the various humors to various organs.
Okay.
And which were also key to various astronomical phenomena.
Yeah, so
there was the idea of astrology in the Middle Ages was some people ascribed to it, some didn't, but in academic medicine there was some schools of thought that said that astrology would influence your health.
Okay. So with the humors, you mentioned them a little bit before, but there was yellow bile, black bile, blood, and phlegm.
Yeah.
We don't know particularly what black bile was.
Do you?
No, it's probably what you might guess it might be.
Yeah, dark fluids that aren't blood.
Yes. And could you describe the whole, I mean, we hear it a lot kind of when we read Shakespeare, even though that's obviously an early modern period thing, but this sort of what each kind of humor corresponded to in terms of personality.
Well, first I'm going to tie them to the seasons because it makes this a bit easier to explain. Mm-hmm. So each of the four humors were also tied to the four seasons. So in the springtime, you would have blood. Mm-hmm. Your blood would increase, and that, especially in young men, and that was the idea of being hot-blooded.
Mm. Choleric?
No, actually, sanguine.
Sanguine? I'm so bad at this.
You'd be excitable, lustful, and so forth if you had an imbalance with blood. Mm. In the summer, yellow bile, because that was hot and dry. And yellow bile is choler.
Yeah. That makes had to be one of them.
Make you... The sin that would have been ascribed to that was covetousness. I should say that in earlier classical medicine, these wouldn't have been considered sins or vices per se, but in the Middle Ages, they were tied to the imbalance of the humors leading to specific sins.
I see.
So like I said, blood would lead to lust and overindulgence, and that was the worst with young men in the spring, because they had too much blood. In the summer, you would have yellow bile, which would make you covetous, sad. Okay. In the fall, black bile, which would cause melancholy, generally make you a miserable person, cause deceit and envy. And then in the wintertime, your greatest element or greatest humor would be phlegm, which would make you lazy, idle, and get colds a lot because you had lots of phlegm running out of your brain.
Yeah, and none of these things are entirely ridiculous.
No,
I mean the phlegm makes a lot of sense.
Thinking about what kind of knowledge they had at the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you see a guy get a cold a lot. There's this, and it tends to happen in the winter when everyone's a bit run down.
Yes,
so that's the phlegm.
It's a perfect sense, right?
Yeah, it does make sense. A lot of these old theories that we sort of laugh at, like phlogiston theory and stuff, but yeah.
It's the general problem that a medieval doctor and a classical doctor would have to just look at the body as a whole. And by the time a disease became physically manifest in the body, it would usually be too late to treat it.
That's still true. So, in many, many cases. Okay, so I do have a copy of The Measly Middle Ages by Terry Deary, of the Horrible History series, which I read a lot as a child. It's very well thumbed. Book you people out there might be able to see. So there is a section here, it's called Dreadful Disease, and let's see if there's anything that could be fun down here. So there's a section here called Crazy Cures, and again, it's not strictly true that they're crazy, so for the plague is what it's talking about here. It's page 32 for those of you who are interested in citation. People mistakenly believe that you could catch the plague by looking at a victim, breathing bad air, and drinking from poisoned wells. Any thoughts on that?
Well, in the context of the time, none of those are particularly crazy.
No. What about for a toothache, wearing a magpie's beak around the neck?
That sounds more like folk medicine.
Okay.
It's entirely possible that people have done this. It doesn't seem like something that a full-time medieval physician would have prescribed, per se.
Yeah, and that was sort of the difficulty you mentioned earlier. We'll come back to that in a second. So, what about cutting a hole in the skull to let out the devil and cure madness?
Well, trepanation, we have evidence of that happening in prehistoric times.
Okay.
So, it's not something particularly limited to the Middle Ages. People did it prehistoric times, in Sumer, and in the classical period, Greece, Rome, Middle Ages.
Did it ever have any beneficial effect that you know of?
As beneficial as pounding a hole in someone's head could possibly be.
Fair enough.
I suppose if you had to release some kind of pressure there of some sort, but that doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, actually, surprisingly, that does make it. What?
Said I'll leave that to the med student to say.
Well, I could see that if you'd had some kind of a bleed, like a, I think they're called subarachnoid hemorrhages. Maybe, like, just relieving the pressure would be good, but I don't know. I don't really know what they're doing or how deep they're going in. So
it is important to note that people did survive this procedure.
Yeah, that was the main question, was did people live through it?
Yes, people did live through it. They probably didn't enjoy it when it happened.
Uh-huh.
They did live.
So what about throwing sweet-smelling herbs on a fire to clear the air?
That also ties into the idea, the kind of classical ideas of the four elements and so on.
We haven't really lost that. People still use herbal candles and
those
rock salt lights kind of things.
Again, there was no germ theory or so on. There was the idea that fresh air was better than bad air, and there was lots of plans even into the 19th century revolving around.
Here's a good
getting
one.
Getting bad air in cities.
Try letting blood out of the patient when the patient's horoscope is right.
So bloodletting is one of those things that physicians were famous for.
Barber surgeons.
Through the classical period to the medieval period. Yeah. He has something wrong with him. Bleed him. Leeches, right?
Yes.
Doctors were referred to as leeches sometimes. Not as they themselves were bloodsuckers, per se.
Here's an interesting one. Kill all the cats and dogs in the town. I think this
was done during the plague.
Yeah.
In a few cities because they believed that the dogs and cats were carrying the disease. Which, if they had extrapolated towards the rats...
Yeah, that is the leading
theory. It would have
been
a better idea. The problem was that they killed the dogs and cats and the rats multiplied.
Because I think the plague is generally thought to be Yersinia pestis, which I'm pretty sure
is
rats.
The flea would be carried by the rats.
Yeah. All right. What about shaving a live chicken's bottom and strapping it to the plague sore?
That just sounds ridiculous.
Here's the thing, though, is that people will read a book like this, even though this is, like, a for children's thing, and some of it's a bit suspect. But then they'll be like, yeah, but that's because they were crazy in the Middle Ages. And maybe it's probably one of those anecdotal kind of
things. Yeah, anecdotal.
But people seem to think that anything that was written down in the past is somehow given veracity by it.
It's especially bad with the Middle Ages because a lot of the authors had very odd senses of humor.
For example?
But unfortunately, I don't think any of them would be particularly appropriate for this video because a lot of the humor in the Middle Ages was incredibly vulgar and involved sex, the body, lots of fart jokes, obviously.
So really, people haven't changed all that much, is what you're saying.
No.
Okay. So then, I think that'll probably be good enough for Horrible Histories for now. So let's move on and shift a little bit into what errors do scientists nowadays tend to propagate about the medieval period?
Well, they generally see the Middle Ages as a dark age, which set humanity back a few hundred or maybe a thousand years. Because there was a loss of classical learning, and then that classical learning was rediscovered in the Renaissance, and then, lo and behold, science began again. And, of course, that classical learning wasn't actually lost in the Middle Ages. It was kept within the church and preserved in texts, and later propagated through scholasticism and church schools, and church schools begat universities, which our university system now is a direct descendant of the one in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. That's like Aquinas and all those people.
Yes, all that stuff.
All that
starting
stuff.
Starting with Charlemagne's time, the beginning of the church schools.
Although, is Aquinas medieval, or have I misplaced him?
Aquinas is definitely medieval.
Okay, yeah. It's probably just because I'm thinking of...
Yeah, a lot of the old
I'm thinking of Institutus. And he's definitely early modern because there's printing press.
So Aristotelian thought, which was usually said to have disappeared in the Middle Ages, was actually incorporated into Christian theology.
They liked Aristotle and his prime mover. They definitely did.
Yes, they definitely liked Aristotle. They liked Ptolemy. Mm-hmm. They liked all that good stuff from the classical times, as long as they were able to make it agree with the Bible.
Shifted around.
And in that respect, it was actually the fact that the church had incorporated these beliefs and followed it so dogmatically that made it so difficult to break away from those beliefs in the Renaissance, which was the predicament that Galileo got into.
And that's the vlog of itself.
Really?
Okay. Anything else in particular? Any good quotes that you can, or stories that you've encountered in your life of science people just being terribly naive about the actual sophistication of the medieval period?
Well, there's definitely the flat earth fallacy, which gets repeated over and over again, which is the idea that people in the Middle Ages thought the earth was flat, and then Columbus went, no, the earth is round, and proved it, and everyone was like, oh my god, when actually in church thought and in general academic thought, obviously among peasants they wouldn't have known, but in higher circles, people did know that the earth was round.
Yeah.
And the general objection to Columbus sailing around it was that if you don't hit a continent, you'll probably die on the voyage. It being so long.
Just to get back to your comment about the peasants probably didn't care, do you want to just reiterate how it's sort of difficult to know what peasants thought?
Yes, the general problem that written texts were... the whole process of writing and recording was confined to within the church. And later on among the nobility, whereas you wouldn't get, there were some peasants that did learn how to read, but it's just a minuscule amount. So a lot of the oral traditions that were carried on by peasants are completely lost because they were never recorded.
Yeah, and that's why you said it was much easier to focus on academic medicine versus folkloric.
Yes.
See, it all comes around in a circle, people.
Not only because there weren't peasants to write it down, but the people who did have the capacity to be able to record this stuff had no interest in it. Which is why a lot of the pre-Christian beliefs in Eastern Europe, even though the Grand Duchy of Lithuania didn't convert until the mid-14th century, are lost. They were just never recorded because they were thought to be pagan beliefs and not worth recording in the first place.
What were the big medical thinkers at the time, or at least who were the thinkers that people subscribed to in their thoughts on medicine?
The big problem with talking about big medical thinkers in the Middle Ages is that there were specific physicians that we can refer to from medieval Europe. The famous doctors were in the Islamic world, generally Jews and Arabs, as opposed to Christianity. And there was also the ascribing to classical, deferring to classical sources all the time, which obscures who was particularly influential in the Middle Ages.
Okay.
However, a classical figure that was influential was Galen. Galen was a huge figure in medieval medicine. And Galenic medicine had married the ideas of the empiricists and the dogmatists classical times into a kind of core philosophy of medicine where you would have your old text, and as long as they weren't proven wrong, you would ascribe to those, but you would have to build on those core texts. But what made Galen appeal so much to early Christians was that he emphasized immoderation as the cause of illness. Drinking too much, having too much sex, having too much joy in your life.
Well, the drinking too much makes sense.
Yes.
The having too much sex is... that's an interesting one.
STDs.
Oh, that kind of having too much sex. I see. Not so much volumes as variety.
You have to remember that the condom was only widespread in the early modern period.
Yes. Oh, the Renaissance. Okay, so, bestiaries. Something that you think is kind of interesting. Lay it on me.
Well, it's mostly because we have bestiaries that do document plants, animals, and their supposed healing properties.
Like the mandrake, say.
Like mandrake root.
Mm.
The problem with medieval bestiaries is that they were copied from sources that came from late antiquity. So a lot of the errors in regards to animals and cures come from the source texts, and also the fact that they were describing plants and various animals that the monks who were copying and adding material into these texts didn't have any direct experience with.
Like,
so these errors would just get propagated. Hearsay would end up in it. It was basically like a hand-copied Wikipedia.
with illumination.
Yeah, so it's actually a very poor source of seeing what people actually thought these various plants could do or bits of animals could do in regards to medicine.
So like the mandrake thing where it was believed that people thought that they had to use a dog to pull it out of the ground because the root itself would scream and kill you. Probably nobody actually cracked
that. The problem being that then it was supposed to kill the dog, and I'm sure somebody who tried it out one time realized that the dog was still alive.
Or perhaps somebody just said, screw this, and pulled it out, and it was fine.
Yeah.
Or more likely, they hadn't encountered the bestiary in Reddit to know. And just
that, too, is completely possible.
Hey, I'm learning, potentially. All right, well, thanks very much for coming in and chatting about the medieval period. It seems to be all I do with these
shows.
Yay! And I'm sure I'll have you back, because there's lots to talk about.
Oh, yes.
All right. Yeah.
Good night.
Good night. Morning, whenever you're watching this.